Hello and welcome to the Gandhara, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. The massive Taliban attack to the military base in northern Afghanistan is having first time in this scale and unprecedented consequences to the Afghan security officials. Minister of Defense in Army Chief already stepped down. President Ghani also replaced or removed heads of 5 out of 6 army corpses, with around 150 soldiers dead in a single attack. This incident also went into the books as one of the deadliest Taliban attacks in Mazar-e-Sharif, which was so far known as one of the most peaceful towns in northern Afghanistan. On today's Gandhara podcast, we will look into what happened that day, how and why it happened, what does it say about the Afghan military and Taliban's capacity, and what are the possible consequences of the attack and likely implications going forward. To discuss the subject, I have Luke Coffey, who currently heads the Heritage Foundation's Foreign Policy Institute and is one of the architects of UK's Afghanistan strategy. Luke is joining us from Washington, D.C. Michael Simple is joining us from UK, who's the visiting professor at the Queen's University in Belfast. Earlier, Michael served as the EU's deputy chief of mission to Afghanistan. Abu Bakr Siddiq is with us today from Prague, who's the editor of Gandhara website, which is Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's special section looking into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Thank you and welcome, gentlemen, to the Gandhara podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you. Walaikum salam. So talking about the attack, death toll continue rising. Abu Bakr, please take us through what really happened on that day.
Well, what we know, we now know greater details of this attack a few days ago, in which about 10 Taliban fighters infiltrated the main base, our Afghan army base in northern Afghanistan. They were disguised as Afghan soldiers. In fact, one of the fighters was disguised as an injured soldier. And they went into the base without being detected, and they attacked the main gathering, which was basically people coming out of the mosque after offering the afternoon prayers. The Afghan commandos were able to eventually kill all the attackers after at least 5 or 6 hours. This is kind of a huge security breach, but it also kind of exposed all the weaknesses that the Afghan security forces have. I think the main takeaway from this message is that the Afghan forces still lack a credible system of vetting all its members. There are huge, it was basically an intelligence failure. The Afghan intelligence agency again failed to predict and prevent such an attack. And then, of course, it was also a huge morale boost to the Taliban, who are looking at beginning another fighting season with the traditional spring offensive in the offing.
Did normalcy return to the base as of today?
Normalcy returned to the base. I think there are still some bodies that are not claimed, but this attack has generated a lot of resentment and anger. Most of these were very young, some were even teenagers. So this kind of butchering of a lot of youth in one day has raised a lot of emotions against the government and its ability to effectively counter the Taliban insurgents.
Let's bring on that, Michael. Though exact death toll varies depending on what source you are looking at, but most estimates put the number around 140 or 150. It's a huge loss. Why so much casualty in one single attack, Michael?
I think that this attack is clearly horrifying when you reflect on the sheer number of young people who've been struck down in one day. But it should not be surprising that we knew that this kind of attack was being planned. And I'm sure that as we speak now, other similar attacks are also being planned. So, when you look at this question, why so many dead? of course, you can unpick the details of what actually happened that day in Mazar. You know, the reason is because these attackers managed to trick their way in, and they managed to get into an area where on a Friday afternoon at Jumu'ah Namaz, the majority of the young soldiers were going around without their weapons. So basically, for a while, the Taliban were able to fire on essentially defenseless soldiers. That's that's a very specific answer to that particular attack. The bigger question is, why are there so many casualties repeated day after day, week after week? It's because, of course, there is a war on. And because the Taliban are engaged in a very effective military campaign, and as Abu Bakr just said, they're in the process of scaling up their offensives for 2017. And this kind of attack is really at the heart of the Taliban strategy. Mm. And interestingly, there is a kind of mirror image between what the US and the government are doing and how they are approaching the war and how the Taliban are approaching the war. Both sides have opted to focus on special forces type operations for their military offensives. And what we saw on Friday in Mazar was the Taliban version of special forces going into action.
Mm-hmm. Luke, what you can tell us about the timing of this attack?
I'll echo what Abu Bakr and Michael have said about, this is something you traditionally see in Afghanistan this time of year. In the spring, you start to see, a ramp up in the fighting. You see the initial spectacular attack, as they call it, at the beginning each year. And in this case, it was this horrible attack in Mazar-i-Sharif. But I think it does raise questions about some of the basic tactical level capabilities of the Afghan security forces. And there are also strategic implications as well, but I think it's important to separate the two. For the past, more than a decade, it's been about a decade since we've been doing it seriously. We've been training the Afghan security forces on basic soldiering. And, protecting one's base and controlling who enters and who doesn't enter is a basic soldiering skill. So the fact that these Taliban were able to dress up as Afghan soldiers and sneak onto the base and be able to do this without being prevented from doing so in the beginning or from being stopped earlier or sooner tells a lot about the lack of basic soldiering skills that must exist, at least in this unit, in the Afghan National Security Forces. One point I would make that slightly differs from what Michael said, I don't necessarily think that this is sort of the Taliban's equivalent of use of special forces, because usually when you use highly trained, highly skilled special forces, the goal is that they extract themselves safely after the operation. And in the case of the Taliban, this is just a continuance of their desire to use suicide as one of their tools. If you're willing to die yourself to kill others, then you can carry off an attack like this with greater ease than you otherwise would be able to if you had to worry about how the hell you would get out of the fight, get out of the battle alive. So that's an important consideration, I think, to make.
Mm-hmm. Michael, feel free to comment on what Luke has just said on your comment. Otherwise,
I will throw in something. I don't think that Luke and I are disagreeing. Obviously,
exactly.
Obviously, the Taliban have to vary their tactics because they don't have all the resources that the U.S. or even the Afghan army have. Essentially, they do not have helicopters to fly them in and pick them up and take them away. And so they use martyrdom as an alternative. And unfortunately, they still have camps which are full of young men who are training, to follow in the footsteps of those people who carried out the slaughter in Mazar. And that is an unfortunate reality.
And this isn't the problem that just, faces the Afghan security forces. Remember a couple of years ago when the Taliban breached the perimeter at Camp Bastion, or Camp Leatherneck, whatever you want to call it, and I think took out the equivalent of 1/5 of the U.S. Marine Corps' Harrier fleet. And again, this goes back to basic soldiering, being able to protect your base and your perimeter.
Mm-hmm. Coming back to my earlier point about the timing, Abu Bakr, maybe you want to jump in here. Talking about the timing, I was also thinking about the continued tension between Governor Atta and the President Ghani. In fact, the discussion about Governor Atta's departure is increasingly the topic of the town these days. Any possible connection between these two efforts in the attack, Abu Bakr?
Well, obviously, there is no visible or clearly established link. I mean, to my knowledge, has not seen anything reported to that end. But definitely the dysfunction of national unity government in Afghanistan, which actually is a misnomer because it is everything but united, has given the Taliban space to operate. It has the fighting on top among the top leadership level of this government has undermined the working of all Afghan institutions, and that includes the security institutions. We should not forget that I'm not a military man, but I mean, creating a new military is not easy, and it's extremely difficult in a country that has been at war for decades. In Afghanistan's case, I think it was very difficult to create a military out of, what were essentially former warring factions. And we should also point out that the Taliban have used in this kind of atmosphere of mistrust, recrimination, a lot of factional jealousies and maybe rivalries. Taliban have successfully used this tactic of insider attack, where they either infiltrate Afghan army units to target Afghan and NATO forces, or they have simply influenced somebody who is not actually a Taliban member, but I mean a member of the Afghan security forces, a soldier or officers who eventually turns his gun on fellow soldiers. So obviously, if there is no direct link between what is exactly happening politically in Mazar or between Mazar and Kabul, the dysfunction of the National Unity Government and I have to say, to be fair, the dysfunction of all Afghan administrations since 2001 adds to this atmosphere in which Taliban have increasingly captured more territory. And I just returned from Pakistan, and what I heard there was that this fighting season, the Taliban are going to push for capturing maximum territory.
Mm-hmm. Just to emphasize on states of Mazar as one of the peaceful cities, at least so far in Afghanistan, which was largely due to these soldiers who were brutally murdered. And now, Michael, what does this attack say about the security of Mazar-e-Sharif as a peaceful city going forward?
Well, I have a slightly different take on why the Taliban chose Mazar for this attack. Mm-hmm. I think that the Taliban want to sustain a military offensive throughout the year, and they want to create an impression of insecurity across Afghanistan. So, if God forbid, one of you walked into wherever the Taliban sit and plan this kind of thing, and offered intelligence from inside a military base anywhere around the country, and you seemed credible, I'm sure they would give you a hearing. In other words, they're open to attack military bases anywhere in the country. They attacked a base in Khost around the same day. So they are open to attacks across the country. I think Mazar was particularly attractive for them precisely because the Taliban have a reputation of operating along the Afghan-Pakistan frontier. And you cannot create an impression of being about to take over the country if you're just along the Afghan-Pakistan frontier. So for them to project themselves up as far as Mazar, really the opposite end of the country from the Pakistan-Afghan frontier, it gives the impression that they're operating across the country. However, the reality is that the Taliban did not depend upon support from the sort of the population, people inside Mazar. They did not overwhelm the sort of the security perimeter around Mazar. They tricked their way into a military base for a self-limiting operation, which they were all going to get killed in. So, I mean, it's a dreadful shock. Lots of people are angry, hurt, somewhat intimidated by it. But unfortunately, this is a country at war. So, you know, next day, things carry on as normal, with the exception that, of course, many people swear revenge and promise that they will carry on fighting. So, I mean, they bloodied, yes, angered, yes, but Mazar is still the same Mazar that it was last Thursday.
Interesting. Now, there are lots of questions about this attack, as well as on increasingly deteriorating security situation in northern Afghanistan. Just to take some credit here, when we started talking about the changing security picture of the north like 3 or 4 years ago, we were very much criticized by some circles as if those reportings were exaggeration. Now, things have reached to this point, like Kunduz fell twice to the Taliban. Most of it is countrysides are no-go zone, and things are not really different in many other provinces in northern Afghanistan. So coming back to this attack in Mazar, we also learned that the dead bodies of fallen soldiers were kept for days in the base, allegedly because it was so dangerous to send them by route, and Afghan security forces were unable to provide needed protection to those vehicles carrying the dead bodies back to their hometowns in Jawzjan, Takhar, or Badakhshan, etc. Also, the other day I was in a conference in DC where the former Afghan Minister of Finance Anwarul Haq Ahadi was the key speaker. As you know, he's in opposition these days, but he was accusing President Ghani of being incompetent to manage the country. So the bigger question is, as many of you have already raised, who is to blame behind an increasing failure of the Afghan forces to provide needed security? How will the massive firing of the top security officials improve the security situation? After the break, we will continue discussing these and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Gandhara Podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Majlis Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Central Asia from local perspective, and the podcast is published every week, most probably Saturdays, on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Gandhara Radio Free Europe Radio Liberties podcast focusing on Pakistan and Afghanistan. We are discussing the recent massive attack by the Taliban on the Afghan army base in Mazar-e-Sharif and its possible implications. Joining me in the discussion are Luke Coffey, head of the Heritage Foundation's Foreign Policy Institute, who was also one of the architects of UK's Afghanistan strategy. Michael Simple is with us, who's the visiting professor at the Queen's University in Belfast. Earlier, Michael served as the EU's Deputy Chief of Mission to Afghanistan. Abu Bakr Siddiq is joining us, who is the editor of Gandhara website, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties section, which looks into Pakistan and Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara podcast here in Washington, D.C. So I was just reading first-hand report by the local Tulu TV journalist who visited the base after the attack. According to him, the attackers were 10 people, all in Afghan military uniforms. They came in two different vehicles. When they were stopped in the first checkpoint, they killed all the soldiers on the spot. Then they moved on to crush soldiers in the second checkpoint leading to the base. And then they walk around. Some of them went on taking down soldiers in the canteen, some in toilets, some in mosques. So the way attackers got into the compound, the way they organized themselves in the base, what does it tell you as a former military person, Luke, in terms of Afghan military, in terms of Taliban's preparedness?
Well, it tells me that if you're willing to kill yourself in the process of killing others, you can do a lot of damage. I think that we've seen a gradual shift, perhaps, in some of the tactics and techniques used by suicide attackers. Whereas, you know, maybe a few years ago, this would have been, you know, a bunch of suicide bombers. I think that the Taliban and other groups have realized that you can often inflict more damage with an assault rifle, because the bomb is a one-time thing. And with the attacking with an assault rifle, you have multiple opportunities until you yourself are killed to kill others. But it does show a complete breakdown on the local military level in terms of defending the space. I've actually visited this base in the past. It's like what you would expect in Afghanistan. The infrastructure is there to defend it. Has robust fencing and checks and towers and everything else. But if you don't have the trained soldiers to guard it, none of that means anything. Okay. And I think that's probably what we've seen here. You asked the question earlier, well, who is responsible for this? I think there are maybe two answers to this question. I mean, the person bearing the on the ground responsibility, I would say, would be the commander, the unit commander. To allow such a lax level of force protection on the base at that time. But there's going to be, as was already alluded to, huge political fallout here. Ghani has already replaced the defense minister and the chief of the army staff, and then, as you said, 5 out of 6 corps commanders. This gives him an opportunity to make fresh appointments, which will no doubt be viewed as controversial among the so-called unity government. It creates even more friction between Atanor and Ghani. And I think an important area to explore and to consider is, what does this mean for Atanor's political future? Hmm. Of course, it's my opinion that he, although he loves Balkh province, he has national ambitions. And, how will he be viewed in terms of responsibility? Or will he come out of this politically? Because this is, this was a pretty big... big deal for Afghanistan, mm-hmm. because of the way the attack was carried out, mm-hmm. and I don't think we've even begun to felt the long-term political ramifications, mm-hmm. of it.
Let's bring Abu Bakr. How Atanor is coming out from this? Is there any news on that?
Well, I think Atanor is trying to. I think he recently had a lot of political problems after this kind of botched attempt to unseat Abdullah. And to claim Jamiat's leadership. Jamiat is the political party that he comes from, and also Afghan chief executive Abdullah comes from. During late last year, Noor engaged in these extensive negotiations, power sharing negotiations with President Ghani, but nothing came out of it. Eventually, he's still in Mazar, but he definitely has national ambitions. I think his biggest challenge is to kind of first consolidate his grip over the Jamiat organization. I have to point out that with whatever is being said about Noor is kind of more of the Sevi type of political operatives among the former Mujahideen. He has kept peace in Mazar, not because he's militarily very strong or something, but I think he's politically very active. He engages with people. He has good relations with a lot of the communities and has their backing. And that is a political skill that is frankly needed in Kabul right now. To end my point, I think he's also kind of extending an olive branch to Hizb-e Islami now. Because he's the only Jamiat leader who has put up billboards in Kabul welcoming Hikmatyar.
Oh, interesting. Talking about the national fallout, Michael, as Luke alluded to earlier, now the defense minister is gone, army chief is gone, and President Ghani also either replaced or dismissed the other 5 military corps commanders. How does this help in this situation?
Well, I think we can look at this two ways. Part of the big picture is that what's going on is a competition between two sets of organizations. There's the Taliban are themselves an organization. They now, many of us are very critical of much of what they do, and particularly this completely unnecessary bloodshed. But as an organization, they've proven extremely robust and quite effective. I know that some of the U.S. military on the ground have often fed back about they being surprised at the effectiveness of the enemy that they've sometimes faced. They're an organization with available minimal resources, but they managed to extract maximum performance from them. And of course, you know, this is a long-term conflict against the organizations that, you know, the United States and its allies have been helping, the Afghan government, its civilian departments, and its military. And, you know, what we've been talking about for the discussion till now has been about organizational failure, about having the wrong person in the job, somebody been there too long, somebody with last discipline, you know, people who don't know what to do or aren't present when they ought to be. And that's where you get this organizational competition at the moment. Amazingly, after a decade and a half of international intervention and all attempts to try and bring this insurgency to an end, the Taliban are, you know, still in the field and ready to put up another very bloody fight this year. But now that's the one thing on the competition between the two sets of organizations. In terms of what happens with this politically, now, you know, one would sort of think that a country in which the government and the whole system faces an existential threat. Because, you know, the Taliban, certainly, they're planning to topple some provinces and they would like to trigger instability. They would like to persuade the U.S. that there's nothing more to do in Afghanistan. It's a hopeless case. You know, the Taliban do pose a genuine threat to the survival of the Afghan state. Now, in other times and other places, that's where you get a move towards unity. People set aside their differences and agree that they're okay. We'll work together until we overcome the enemy. Like, you remember this of the multi-party government you had in UK during the Second World War. Mm. Now in Afghanistan we have the name of a national unity government, but actually at times like this we see that the disasters like Mazar, they provoke new rounds of criticism. You know, you get sackings, but not everybody's convinced that the people who are brought in to replace those who have been sacked, you know, are any better. That you get senior figures tend to distance themselves from the government, actually criticize the government. And remember that when it comes, you know, when you're talking about what happens to Atanur and this kind of thing, remember that the military bases are, they ultimately answer to the Ministry of Defense, and they are completely centralized. And in Afghanistan, power is centralized towards the presidential palace. Mm. So people who've got a local power base, like Atanur, ultimately they can wash their hands of these things and say, if only I'd been in charge, I could have done better. And the pressure actually grows on the central government. And I'd be extremely worried that the part of the repercussion of this is that you find all those who should have a stake in the survival and the reform of the system instead turn around, you know, and criticize the central government for its performance. And everybody says, well, I wasn't actually involved. Somebody else was in charge.
Interesting. Look, when all these were happening, like all these shakeups were going on, taking place in the Afghan military or the defense sector, U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis arrived to Kabul with previously an unannounced trip. Was there any effort by Washington to put things in order?
It's difficult to say if General Mattis's trip was planned in advance or he decided to fly out in response to this attack, because many of these trips are unannounced, right? So it's not unusual for this sort of thing to happen. But I will say that the timing of General Mattis's trip in this case was fortuitous, because he was able to, I think, show a presence on the ground and try to maybe alleviate some concerns that many might have in Afghanistan about the new administration in Washington and how is going to view this challenge. The whole Afghan issue in the United States right now is really weird from my point of view. I mean, we had an election campaign where Afghanistan was barely mentioned once since President Trump has come into power. What U.S. policy towards Afghanistan is going to be hasn't been an issue. There's very little discussion. There are very few rumors around town on what to expect. And even with this attack in particular, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, this would have been, I think, big news even in the United States. Mm-hmm. And when the news broke, it was early morning here in the U.S., and it got some coverage on the, you know, cable news networks. Right. But that was about it. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't much reporting at all. And I was expecting a very busy news cycle on this particular issue. Hmm. I mean, compare this in contrast to the recent use of the so-called mother of all bombs, yeah, which generated, you know, nonstop news coverage, mm-hmm, unduly, in my opinion, but nevertheless was, you know, dominated the airwaves. But with this attack, it was hardly reported at all, along with Afghanistan.
Yeah, you were right. Abu Bakr, the attack on military base in Mazar-e-Sharif was claimed by the Taliban. And I think the Kabul hospital attack was claimed by IS earlier. So do we know, most importantly, does the Afghan authorities know who's who in this environment?
Well, I think they do know in most cases after the event, if there are complete investigations. I think in some cases they have found it. In some of these attacks, there was not one organization involved. In fact, there were many. Like in some of the attacks last year on Shia shrines in Kabul, they found out that there was Islamic State, but there was also Lashkar-e-Jangvi, which is a Pakistani organization, but is now most of its members are, or senior members are, hiding in southern Afghanistan in the province of Zabul. But I think, by and large, the Afghan government still has little capacity in investigating such attacks, in preventing such attacks. And I would like to point, I mean, we have been mostly talking about tactics here, but I think there are some key strategic questions at stake now. One of the key questions before the new administration is, and I'm sure that folks in Washington or folks in President Trump's national security team are thinking about it. I mean, what's the end state that United States is seeking in Afghanistan, and how far they are willing to go that way? One comment that really stood out for me in the recent week was the comment by General John Nicholson, who said that the use of this bomb, so-called mother of all bombs, in eastern Afghanistan was a purely tactical decision. Mm. So are we going to see these kind of tactical decisions where there'll be a temporary increase of U.S. troops or military aid to Afghanistan, or are we going to see a renewed push for a comprehensive political settlement, which I think in most people's views remains the only ultimate solution?
The noise behind that mother of all bomb thing was also because I think it was used against IS, and IS for some reason gets more attention in the U.S. media. So talking about today's Afghanistan, who's the worst enemy, Michael? Is IS or the Taliban?
Yes, I wanted to come back on that one. Thanks for asking. Going back to the attack on the military hospital in Kabul some time back, that's what's known in the business as a false flag attack. In terms of the tactics used, in terms of everything around the way that the operation was organized, it was exactly the same as what happened in Mazar. Mm. And because it was carried out by the same people as part of the same program of, you know, Taliban special forces style operations. However, they have their own calculations, and they no doubt received advice on this, that the repercussions of carrying this out in Kabul would be a little bit too difficult for them and anybody who backs them, and therefore they managed to arrange for the distraction of a claim coming in from Daesh, Islamic State. Islamic State in Afghanistan does not have the capacity to carry out this kind of attack, and they didn't. So that it was the same Taliban carrying out the attacks on the hospital in Kabul as carried out the attack in Mazar. Now, sure, Islamic State is it is a brand rather than a presence inside Afghanistan. They do not provide an existential threat to the survival of the Afghan government the way that the Taliban do, but they are there and they do complicate things. For example, we were talking earlier about the the implications, the ramifications of the Mazar attack, and the question of what next. And I almost, on an almost philosophical level, you ask, does this kind of dreadful violence, does it pay? Today, in the next door northern province, in Jawzjan, the Taliban were driven out from almost all the positions which until they have now held, because some people who have chosen for the moment to, you know, raise a black flag and describe themselves as Daesh have rebelled against the Taliban, driven them out of Kushtipa, driven them out of Darzab, and as of this evening, the Taliban have been wiped out of the next door province. Now, nobody came from Syria over this, and do you really take it as seriously as Daesh? No, it's a complicating factor, which has got the Taliban almost as worried as the US and the Afghan government. It's a warning that Afghanistan runs the risk of, after two decades, reverting to the situation it was back in the mid-90s when the Taliban came into being, cut into territories disputed between different rival factions.
Very interesting. Unfortunately, we have to end the discussion. But before that, as you mentioned, Michael, so from whatever direction you look at, the Afghan government is challenged by a number of issues. Taliban and Daesh is just one of them. Separately, people are absolutely dissatisfied from lack of action on earlier promises. Unemployment is a major issue. Within the government, corruption remains the biggest challenge. Lack of unity at the top is a major, major threat to the Afghan government itself. So does the Afghan government has the capacity to take on all those challenges at once, Luke?
Well, this has been the problem for years. And I think, obviously, the answer to that question, sadly, is no. Maybe it's because we have an unrealistic set of expectations on what we're hoping for the Afghan government to achieve. Or maybe it's because we've been pursuing the wrong path for too long, and now we've dug ourselves a hole. But no, I don't think that the Afghan government has the ability right now to handle all of these challenges. I think that we need to be a little bit more realistic about what we think the government can achieve and what the Afghan people can achieve, and what the situation is going to look like on the ground in Afghanistan for the foreseeable future. Until there's a political settlement in place, there's no hope for peace, but there doesn't seem to be the drive or willingness by all the key players for a political settlement. And there will be an insurgency in Afghanistan for my lifetime, I suspect. I mean, just this week we saw 25 Indian soldiers were killed by Maoist insurgents in India, which is the world's largest democracy. And they're fighting an insurgency inside its borders. So just because there's an insurgency, I wouldn't say means that we've failed. I just think we need a realistic look at what we hope Afghanistan to achieve and what we can do to help it achieve in a very realistic and modest way.
Just to conclude, so what's the way out from this, Michael?
The greatest asset available to the Afghan government is the fact that there is an overwhelming desire across the Afghan population, even including many of the Taliban, to see some kind of an end to this conflict. That's the greatest asset. The way forward is tapping into that. It will require international assistance. It will require some more effective political work in Kabul than we've seen until now. And it will require a more effective peace process than we've had until now.
Okay, Abu Bakr?
I agree with Michael, but I think the Afghan government is definitely looking at its Western partners, particularly the United States. So I think Washington has to indicate whether it will go for kind of these tactical solutions, short-term military increase. That is what we have been hearing about is on the cards, or there will be a more kind of comprehensive look at Afghanistan strategy and push towards a settlement, which will, of course, include some kind of reconciliation between the warring sides in Afghanistan.
Okay. Thank you very much for insightful comments. Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Gandhara website, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's official section, looking into Pakistan and Afghanistan. Luke Coffey, head of the Heritage Foundation's Foreign Policy Institute. Michael Semple, visiting professor at the Queen's University in Belfast. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today on Gandhara Podcast.
Delighted. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, your host in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.